This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. So, where are all the black male feminists? And what about gay rap stars? Where are they? Well, if those questions sound odd, it may be because of a widely held and perhaps unexamined idea about black masculinity. Duke scholar Mark Anthony Neal says the image of the black man is trapped between hip-hop ghetto thug and strong black man presented by the likes of Bill Cosby and Louis Farrakhan. And his latest book, Neal offers a vision of a new black man. Neal says that the new black man needs to move beyond patriarchy to embrace feminism and combat homophobia. And while sexism and gay bashing are central to some streams of hip-hop culture, Neal is careful not to blame the crisis in black masculinity on rap music alone. Mark Anthony Neal is an associate professor of black popular culture at Duke University and the author of New Black Man, and he's in the studio with us today. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Frank, how are you doing this afternoon?
Could not be better. Glad to have you on the program and want to invite some phone calls as well. 877-962-9862, the number to call. If you want to talk about the new black man, the crisis in black masculinity, 877-962-9862. Mark Anthony Neal is my guest. Is there a crisis in black culture? Is the black man in crisis?
No doubt the black man is in crisis. I mean, black men have become markers for various issues within the larger society, right? When we think about what the failing of the black family, a lot of that is rooted in this idea that black men aren't taking responsibility. When we think about conversations about criminality in American society, it always seems to target black men. So on the one hand, you have black men who clearly are struggling to define themselves in various ways in American society, but they're also scapegoated in very problematic ways at the same time.
Yeah, you're suggesting they're not in control often of that identity
Oh, not at all. Right, not at all.
How far, this is not a new problem.
This is not a new phenomenon. I mean, the history of Africans in this country, of African Americans, has been the struggle over image, the struggle over controlling images, right, taking back images and redefining them in certain kinds of ways. So we have so many different tropes of black masculinity historically that have been problematic, you know, whether it's Lil Black Sambo or Jim Crow or a range of other things, the hip-hop thug of 2005. So much about black masculinity is about how do we redefine these images and take control of these images and put out a more progressive ideal of what black masculinity is and can be.
And we should go back. Let's get back as far as we can historically and try to get a handle on this. The idea of masculinity in any sense, or for masculinity and femininity, is to have some control over your environment. You lose this back in slave days, and right, this is a thing that now we have to recover in the post-slave era, and there are efforts to do this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think about the role of patriarchy in any society, the idea that men control the domestic space, they go out to make money, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, right, slavery took a lot of that away from African-American men. So there's always been the sense that black men have been trying to reclaim their patriarchal rights. And the way that those rights most resonate, obviously, is in the context of the black domestic space, black households, black right, families, et cetera. But in the larger culture and in the public sphere, it's so much more of a challenge for black men, you know, having to confront the way they're viewed, particularly in the advertising community, television and radio, the print media back, you know, 80 years or so. So what you get is this image of black men, what I call the strong black men. And it can be personified in folks ranging from Frederick Douglass to W.E. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington. If you want to go forward in the 20th century, folks like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, to someone like Bill Cosby today, to some extent. This trope of what it means to be a black man that can be respected in the public sphere. And I'm arguing that, you know, part of the price that we pay as a community for putting this image out there and not holding this image accountable is that we also allow a closing of ranks around black men who often engage in often problematic practices around their sexual politics, around their gender politics, et cetera, et cetera. Men that we could very easily call sexist or misogynist or homophobic in various kinds of ways. And for me, that's a problem because when we hear conversations about this in the large society, it's always attached to hip-hop culture. Is that hip-hop culture is somehow the root of misogyny and sexism in American society. You know, hip-hop culture really takes its lead from what it sees in a larger society, but clearly also what it sees within black masculinity in the black community.
I want to get back to this idea of the strong black man. It's the model itself, because in a lot of ways it does sound like a pretty admirable model. This is a man who takes responsibility, who goes out and earns a living and makes sure that that money is shared with the family that he has. All of that sounds pretty good. But what your suggestion is that it also embraces a kind of patriarchy that is inherently sexist.
Right, and it denies feminist agency. It denies black women in many cases the kind of important voice that they could have, both in terms of the public culture at large and also the black community. I mean, we're hard pressed just on a political level to think of black women who have emerged as political leaders on par with the men that we normally see and think of as black leaders, the Jesse Jacksons, the Al Sharptons, the Louis Farrakhans, the Barack Obamas, et cetera, et cetera.
How much of this is, in your mind, a problem with the model itself, and how much of it has to do with some of the examples or role models? I mean, you talk in the book about embracing Miles Davis. I mean, here's a character who's done a lot to advance culture. On the other hand, his personal life was not at all a model.
And that's an interesting balance, right? How do you affirm, say, the musical genius of a Miles Davis, but also acknowledge and hold him accountable historically now for the fact that he happened to be a domestic abuser, that he did not have the best politics around women who were around him. In fact, there are elements of Miles Davis's life to suggest that he was quite misogynistic, you know, when it comes to this kind of issue. So, you know, it's an interesting kind of balance, right? How do we hold black men accountable for issues of sexism, misogyny, and homophobia, but also acknowledge the larger forces in the society that create the context for which these black men act out certain kind of practices.
I'm talking with Duke University Associate Professor Mark Anthony Neal about his new book, New Black Man, and we're talking about ways of identifying black masculinity in American culture. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Charles is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Charles.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, my question actually is one, being a black professional in the Triangle, you know, the view of us when we enter professional situations is often tailored to very old ways that people are used or tend to want us to act and or accept us to act. And being from a family of professionals with physicians in it and people with graduate degrees, no matter what role you enter into, very easily society tries to push that role back into one that non-professional behavior is acceptable, but even tries to promote that as the view because they will not see the strong, educated, ready to take control of his own image person.
I wonder if you could be, Mark, I'll get you to answer that in a second, but I wonder if you could be more specific about some of the roles that you think may have been put on you that you didn't have control of.
Well, I think sometimes, even in slight ways that people will make, for instance, will tend to be, you know, I'm married and I have a child, and actually the promotion of the view of the family man was something that was very strong as I was raised and what I persisted around. But as I've interacted with people on a professional level, often the view is of that of, oh, well, so you had a father around. Mm-hmm. Oh, you had mm-hmm. professional people in your family. And so many times the view that the general public sees or wants to see is 180 degrees from what you are, they still have a hard time accepting you. There's just no way you can actually be that person that you say you are. And it puts challenges in the way sometimes, because as you persist on, either in professional areas or in education or in economic development, and I use the Triangle because I've been here for 20 years now, having graduated from one of the major universities here, and you're constantly wearing the mantle of, well, will allow you to sort of persist in the, in the way that you say you are, but we still want to reserve the right to pigeonhole you because that's more comfortable.
All right. So how much control do we have, even if we make the intellectual, if we accept what you say intellectually? Thank you, Charles.
I mean, that's something we always come up against. You know, as someone, you know, who is an African-American professor, you know, the days and times that I spend in the various coffee houses in Durham, you know, with my laptop, when folks see me, the first thing in their mind is not that I'm a Duke professor, right? It's a whole range of other things, including folks who had stopped me at various times in my career that asked me if I was taking bets or another case, you know, if I made mixed CDs and things like that, mm-hmm. because, you know, there was just some disconnect between my presence there in the middle of the day and what I might actually be in terms of my career. In terms of the book, though, I mean, it was a very slippery slope that I was working through, because on the one hand, I wanted to affirm black men who were being responsible. But how do you affirm that, but also hold them accountable for certain practices, what I call, you know, the user-friendly patriarchy of the black community that suggested, yes, it's a good thing that black men are in and they're productive and they're raising their families and they're disciplining their children, but how could we expand the range of their activities, both in their communities and their families, that allows for them to be much more progressive around these things? Like the term that I'd use, for instance, in terms of parenthood, how do we talk about a generation of black men who aren't just providers, right? Folks who make the money, come home, provide discipline, provide economically. How do we talk about black men as being nurturers in ways that we naturally think of black women? How do we talk about black men in the context of what I call co-parenting, right? Where the kinds of domestic things that we expect women and mothers to do that men also are very comfortable doing in the context of their everyday lives.
And we'll talk about some of the difficulties in pursuing these in the specific and take many more of your phone calls on the state of things as we talk today about black masculinity in America and its references and as well as its future. Taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Just ahead, more with Mark Anthony Neal about his latest book, New Black Man. Support for the state of things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking today about social constructions of black masculinity in America. Why do so many black men seem hostile to homosexuality, to women's rights? Is feminism something that can be embraced for the black male in America? What exactly do black men have to gain from reexamining their role in the community? Joined by Mark Anthony Neal, Associate Professor of Black Pop Culture in the African and African American Studies Department at Duke University and author of New Black Man. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. If you want to join our conversation about the role of black men, whether it's changing, and the images of black masculinity in America. Before the break, Mark, we were talking about ways to hold black men accountable in this larger model of the strong black man without sort of embracing sexism and homophobia, which seem to be a part of that structure as well. How did, and you believe that feminism plays an important part in that? How so?
Oh, absolutely. It has been for me. And I mean, so much of this book was about, I clearly had a political and ideological goal in writing a book that reexamined and redefines black masculinity. But also realized that I couldn't do that unless I held myself up to some sort of scrutiny. So the book is part memoir. And I talk a great deal about where my politics were. For me, this is a 20-year journey. You know, 20 years ago, 1985, when Alice Walker's The Color Purple is made into a film, I'm among those young black men who were very critical of Alice Walker and Steven Spielberg, the director of the film, for putting out images of black men that were damaging. And there were lots of protests about the film, a lot of folks, very, very critical language from folks like Ishmael Reed and Louis Farrakhan and Tony, journalist Tony Brown at the time. And I was right on the page with that. And, you know, the book is so much about this journey about how I came from that kind of politic to a politic where I suggested I'm a black feminist, black male feminist. And the thing that's intervened for me in that relationship is the fact that I finally had a chance to hear the voices seriously of black feminists, right? Both folks who were my mentors, my teachers, the books that I'm reading. I talk a great deal about the impact that Audre Lorde's work had, for instance, in terms of my thinking about the politics of gender and sexuality within the black community. Mm-hmm. And it's really hearing the critiques coming from the black feminist movement. And they're critiques that are coming out of love, clearly, because they're concerned about the quality of life within the black community. And for me, as a black man, I had to begin to take very seriously those critiques and not just dismiss them as somehow the black feminist critiques of what was happening in the black community was somehow white racism poisoning, you know, conversations around gender and sexuality within the black community.
Yeah, the other part of that criticism, I guess, is that, that this is causing divisions within the black community.
We've got to
close ranks, right. And you also answer that that critique.
And for me, it's been really problematic because there have been certain very visible celebrity figures, for instance. Mike Tyson is someone I write about in this context, who were engaged in practices that are very damaging. I mean, Mike Tyson was accused and convicted of rape. And the idea that we never had a conversation seriously, right, widespread within the black community that owned up to the fact that Mike Tyson was a rapist, that when he comes home, the conversation is about somehow how the white supremacist structure in American society had colluded somehow to bring down Don King and Mike Tyson. And even if that was the case, the fact of the matter is we need to have a conversation with men like Mike Tyson that when women say no, it means no. And yes, Jesserie Washington could be faulted for being in his room 3 o'clock in the morning. She shouldn't have to be raped because of that.
877-962-9862, to talk with my guest today, Mark Anthony Neal. And Jeffrey's on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I think this is very fascinating. For disclosure's sake, I'm a 32-year-old white guy. Question, what does your speaker mean by the black image? Because for a person like myself, who has black male friends that are professionals and have families and they're educated, they seem basically just like me. And then, you know, some folks who, you know, how should I describe it, you know, maybe wear the baggy pants and walk around the mall. And, you know, it's hard. There's not a single image in my mind of a black man any more than there would be a single image of a white man. And maybe you could define what you mean by the image of a black man and let us know who you think defines that. Is it blacks themselves or whites or the whole community or TV or...
Sounds like a good question, Jeffrey. Let's get a response. Thanks for calling.
The caller's dead on, right? There's no one image, you know. Any group of people are diverse, and part of what I'm arguing in the book is that we need to respect the diversity within black communities. But there are images of black men that circulate in the mainstream, particularly through popular culture and media culture, that for folks who, unlike our caller, don't have everyday interactions. Yeah. You know, because my argument would be, you know, those black men who are professionals, who are families, are just like me, just like the young men who are wearing baggy pants, right? There's a kind of fluidity there. But they clearly are images of black men, and of course, Katrina pointed this out, you know, very powerfully, that circulate in the larger culture, particularly in digital culture, television, film, et cetera, that suggests that there's this kind of dangerous black male that's out there that needs to be controlled and curtailed. And it has dramatic impacts when we see how that plays out, for instance, in the prison industrial complex. And the way that, for instance, the images of black men in hip-hop have had effects in terms of domestic policy around the policing of black masculinity, both in a metaphoric sense and a very real political sense.
But Jeffrey's question, and Charles even before that, suggests another important element. Who has control over this?
Ultimately, I think, ultimately, no one group of people can really control the images the way that they want to. Once those things go out into the world, folks are going to do with them what they can. The only thing you can do is really challenge what I call the essentialist images of black men by trying to champion and put out alternative versions of black men. Now, the reason why this is particularly important around discussions of black masculinity within the black community, because as I argue in the book, you know, there are these very small boxes where black men can fit into. And if you don't fit into these boxes, within the community, you're viewed with some suspicion, right? You're not black enough, you're not, you know, male enough, you're not black male enough. And how do we get black men comfortable in their own body so that they don't have to feel like they have to perform a certain kind of notion of black masculinity to be accepted within black communities?
Let's go to the phones. Rashawn is on the line from Greensboro. Hi, Rashawn.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I wanted to call and just to ask a question. I wanted to make a comment also. But when you were talking about the image of the black male and as far as, you know, being the provider and how we could be more nurturing towards our wife and our children. And I that was a very good point because that's something that myself as a black man, I work very hard on teaching my sons how to respect their mother, but not just the fact that she's a mother, but how to respect all black women, really all women, period. But more emphasis being that this is our race that we're dealing with, on how to come up with that mindset to be more sensitive, but more aware of what the woman needs and what the woman wants. And I always tell my oldest son, I say, you can always find out what it is that's going on with the woman by listening to her. And one of the things that, you know, I work with them on is, you know, teaching them, look, get out the car quickly. Get her door for her. You know, talk to her. You know, find out what's going on because you can learn a lot because the woman is the first nurturer. She's the first teacher of the child. And therefore, working with that mindset in my sons is tremendous. But what I think more, what we can do more in our community as black men to teach those who don't have fathers around is to teach them more than just how to be provider, how to come home and maintain the house, but to give them a base as far as how to how to bring about more of an aware mindset, how to be more sensitive and look at the black woman and look at what she needs, because there's a lot of hurt on both sides, the black man and the black woman. As you had said earlier, we've lost our place And we've lost it mainly because of what happened to us in slavery. So we are in need of repair.
Rashawn, I want to ask you to hang on for a second because I want to ask you another question, but I also want to get a response to what you've said so far because it's quite a bit, and I want to get a response from Mark Anthony Neal.
Yeah, I think what the caller mentioned is very important. How do we popularize a mindset that sees black men as not just simply economic providers, right? Mm. I cite in the book a conversation I had with a young man about, fathers being more involved domestically with their children, not just in terms of spending time, but household duties, et cetera. And he, made a comment, I babysit my kids. And my quick response is that, that's part of the problem. The fact that you think that spending time with your kids is an act of babysitting as opposed to an act of parenting is problematic. And I know there's a lot of pressure in our society now in single parent households that are headed by black women to want to respond to that crisis by, getting black men back into the households, right? And that's a long-term struggle. In the interim, what the caller suggests, it's very important for us to get black men who are in our communities, right, to see that they have a vital role to play in terms of nurturing young kids who are in their communities, young boys and girls who are in their communities, and not just in the terms of taking on them as an economic responsibility. Clearly, we're not asking anybody to do that. But to have a presence in our communities where they see a wide range of black masculine figures exist that are very diverse, that have different sexualities, that have different politics, as a way to see that there's a space for them to fit in this larger society.
Is this the idea, though, Rashawn's idea and what you're explaining now, is this where you say sometimes black men get in trouble in their own community, you start talking this way, and there are questions about whether you're black enough and man enough?
Well, that manifests itself these days most powerfully in the conversation about brothers in the DL.
Which
is down low.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, there's a credible amount of fiction that's been written about this, a credible amount of nonfiction. It is the spectacle of black sexuality in America in 2005. And very often when we see black men, because, what a down low black man is simply, the old closeted gay male that we all have been familiar with, in American society. And the kind of risk that many black men think that it is to come out with their sexuality and deal with some of the rabid homophobia, I would argue, in some black institutions, including the black church, where there's a definite risk to acknowledge the full range of their sexuality. And my question becomes, the reason why a lot of men are in the DL is because of homophobia within certain black communities. And while men on the DL have been almost wholly blamed for the rise of HIV rates amongst black women, the idea that they're having unprotected sex with black men while still having sex with their wives and girlfriends, ultimately that's not an issue about black men on the DL. Ultimately, that's an issue about unsafe sexual practices, right? And let's call it what it is and try to create a space where more black people, both black men and women, lesbians and gays, can be much more comfortable with their sexuality within the context of our communities.
Yeah, Rashawn, I want to thank you for your call and move forward with this part of the discussion, and that is about homosexuality and how much more difficult it is for black men to practice. As you suggest, the whole phenomenon of being on the DL suggests there is not a comfortable black gay community as there may be in the white community.
Yeah, the black gay community is in an interesting kind of space. On the one hand, as many black gay writers have written about, there's a difficulty of what it means to be black in white gay communities, right? And then there's a difficulty of what it means to be gay in black communities. And how do you find a way to create a safe space, right, in communities that you love, that you're committed to, where you can be who you are? And while there is increasing numbers of black men and women who are comfortable doing that at this point in time, there's still a lot of folks who don't feel that they can, quote unquote, come out in the context of our communities.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation with Mark Anthony Neal from Duke University, author of New Black Man. Walter is on the line from Greensboro. Hi, Walter.
Hey, man, how you doing? The guy called Anthony Neal, is that the thing?
Say it again.
What's his name? The writer that's...
Mark Anthony Neal.
Mark, come on, bro. I mean, you say you're African-American. I got a 3-year-old son. Our masculinity is not to be gay, bro. I'm a Christian, and in the black community, we don't play that, bro. So don't come out here sounding like, okay, it's okay for you to be gay. That's society. To me, you sound like you're a sellout, bro, because society, the media, the white media, wants to be, okay, it's okay to be gay. I got a 3-year-old son, bro, and that is not happening, bro. You think I want my 3-year-old son to grow up and say, oh, daddy, I'm gay, that's okay. Come on, man. Be real, okay? Just be real and don't come out here talking about we're trying to find that sexuality, bro.
All right. Walter, let's get a response. Thank you for your call.
I mean, the call, I think, just kind of reinforces some of the major points that I'm making in the book. I mean, the immediate attack in the context of this conversation, that somehow my blackness and my maleness gets questioned in the context of this. And I think we have to be realistic about what homosexuality is in American society. There are lots of homosexuals in various communities. We have historical figures, you know, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, as two examples, James Baldwin, who's probably the most well-known gay figure within the black community. And if we create a context in which we're dealing with gays and lesbians, it's homophobic, right? We're actually not taking the opportunity to take advantage of the best of our community. You know, ultimately, what I argue is that when we look at homophobia, homophobia is an attack on humanity. And anything that attacks black humanity should be seen as a problem for black folks in the community. In the same way that we want to challenge white supremacy because it denies the humanity of black folks, the same way that we should challenge sexism and misogyny because it denies the humanity of women, we need to challenge homophobia because it denies the humanity of gays and lesbians in our community.
This gets back to some of the problems that you find with the image of the so-called strong black man, in that it sort of promotes this idea, one that was successfully promoted among poor whites. You may be poor, but at least you ain't black. Well, then, you know, you're black, but you're a black man, but at least you're not a woman. At least you're not gay.
Right. And you understand that a lot of things that come out in black masculinity, black men who feel that they can't be men in a larger society, the one safe haven they've always had to be men has been in their households. And what has been the impact of that kind of those kind of practices over decades?
But also, there was something I heard in Walter's voice that was very deep, very emotional. I mean, how do you address that?
And that's where it becomes difficult, because one of the things I hear, you know, I heard in the caller's voice was a real concern about his son, right? Is my son going to grow up and be gay? And again, part of this is a larger kind of politic among some within the black community that think that homosexuality somehow is a measurement of a damaged masculinity. Right, that homosexuality is what happens when black men have been damaged by white supremacy and a range of other things, economic expectation, et cetera, et cetera. And what I'm trying to say is that we don't need to go down that road. There are too many black men who struggle psychically, who struggle intellectually and emotionally because they don't feel that who they are is going to be respected and embraced within the community because they don't come off as male enough. And I think we need to open up the space, you know, psychically, politically, spiritually, et cetera, to talk about black men and black people just being comfortable with who they are.
Let's go up to Chase City, Virginia. Russell is on the line. Hello, Russell.
Hello. I'm a Presbyterian minister of 51 years practice, and also I taught sociology at a number of colleges. Back in the late 50s, I remember having a conversation with one of the Kinsey associates who, I happen to be African American also, but he was saying that his research back in the 50s in the black community, that there was much more of a tolerance for homosexuality, that a person might say, well, so-and-so is, he's funny, but he's okay, you know. And I think that you have to take some historical looks and see, you know, what's happened to change the outlook. And I'm afraid that some of it has to be laid at the door of some of our religious institutions. The other thing is, if you look at some of the historic studies of black families, you'll find that fathers were as, you know, were there. And I remember talking with some parishioners at one point years ago, and this one lady said, you know, my father plaited my hair. He'd comb it and plait it. We'd be sitting out on the front porch. And many fathers were, you know, did many of the things that the mothers did. Sometimes the mother had to work outside the home, and the father, you know, was the parent for the children.
Well, thank you, Russell. Let's get a look at that historically, how things changed, and the role of the black church.
Yeah, the one thing that I always put it, you know, to blame a great deal, when we go to Daniel Patrick Moynihan's report on the black family, and the report, you know, not to reduce the complexity of it, but what the report essentially said was that for black Americans to be fully integrated in American society, they had to embrace a model of patriarchy. Right. I mean, he argues in part in the report, again, not to dismiss the complexity of it, that part of what, you know, damned the black community as not being able to fully integrate into American society is that there was too much, you know, matriarchal influence within the black community. And of course, some of the black nationalists politically and otherwise, who were invested in notions of building a stronger notion of black masculinity to combat, you know, white supremacy in the 60s, you know, tagged onto that. So you get these strange bedfellows. And it's interesting because now when you look at the black church around its sexual politics, you get those strange bedfellows again. You know, folks who, in terms of public policy, may have no interest, for instance, in what we see in the conservative right, you know, got very easily caught up in conversations about gay marriage in the 2004 election and beyond that, that very often siphoned off African-American votes that would have been placed elsewhere. And that's an interesting kind of discussion because what we see now in some cases is a very virulent, you know, response to homosexuality coming from the black church, where the black church historically has always been a safe haven, right, for a range of black folks.
We are talking today about modern construction of black masculinity, how it shapes black culture in America, and how it shapes the discussion on easing racial tensions across racial lines. Mark Anthony Neal is with us in the studio. He's an associate professor of black pop culture and the African and African American Studies Department at Duke University and author of New Black Man. Just ahead, more of your phone calls at 877-962-9862. On the State of Things, stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Black communities in America face a number of hurdles, and the cultural construction of black masculinity is one of the questions being hotly debated today. We're talking today with Mark Anthony Neal about his latest book, The New Black Man, and taking your calls at 877-962-9862. And Mark, we will talk more about certainly this discussion within the black community. Does this discussion have a value outside? Is there a need to listen to this conversation outside the black community?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, part of this book is a reaction to what I see as a general crisis of masculinity in this country, where masculinity has been reduced to very simplistic things. And any men who just don't fit into those boxes are deemed suspect in so many ranges. I mean, I've been heartened by the number of stories I've seen of men who were the sole providers of their families. And in one case, I remember the guy may have had 12 kids. And he was so compelled to articulate his masculinity, right, that he thought it was in his masculine, it was masculinely important for him to leave his family and go fight in Iraq. And when I see things like that, you know, where he's making a disconnect, men are making disconnects between what roles they can actually play for their families that are important versus chasing some notion of masculinity that has them on the front line of Iraq, that suggests to me that there's a real disconnect around how we think about masculinity in this country.
And it doesn't have to take you to Iraq. The idea of being a provider can take you out of the house, especially these days,
right,
when you think of how much it takes, how much time it takes to provide for a family, for a working person.
And it's very hard to find that balance. I mean, it is so very hard. I mean, it's something I struggle with. And you know, the one thing that academics do have, we have flexible schedules that allow us, you know, to take advantage of different times of the day. But, you know, even in these cases, I could imagine what it's like for those working class men who are working 10 or 12 hours a day, maybe 6 days a week. I mean, that's my father. You know, my father worked 60 hours a week, you know, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. So we did not have any real connection except for Sunday mornings when we listened to gospel music and watched baseball in the afternoon. So on the one hand, you know, I really can't blame him for what he thought he needed to do economically to have an impact on my life. I'm just hoping that by looking at the lessons of my father and looking at the lessons of other men, that it's just another way for us to do this that allows for us to be much more of a presence within the lives of our children.
Let's go out to Durham. Livia's on the line. Hello, Livia.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, well, I was just real interested because I graduated in women's studies a couple years ago from Duke, and was just wondering how your notion of this new, the new black masculinity would fit in with what a lot of us think of as the paradigm of the, you know, feminist black female matriarchy, you know, the old grandma who makes sure everybody goes to church and sings in the church choir and, you know, keeps the whole family in line, and how that sort of serves to, you know, emasculate the black men, and, I mean, how that would work with a new sort of feminist black male.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Livia.
Great question. One of the things that I try to challenge in the book and that I talk about, I mean, when we talk about how black women are viewed in black communities, I mean, it's largely two poles, right? On the one hand, you have the queen, mama, matriarch who's up on a pedestal, and then you have all these other women, right? The women that we see in the music videos, the women who are disparaged, et cetera. And there's no in between. And the thing that I'd like to say is that, you know, those images are both controlling images, right? They're both attempts to control black female expression. And all you have to do is do something very little, when you're up on that pedestal and you fall very quickly to the bottom of that pole. And I think that's a way for us to begin to think about the fact that even these images of black women where black men are affirming the importance that black women play in certain kinds of communities, they're not always progressive, right? Because in many ways, even though it may show a level of respect for black women, it is not allowing for a space for black women to be truly honest, to express who they are as black women, intellectually, emotionally, sexually in particular, right? So many conversations are about controlling black women's sexuality, whether or not it's the rappers, you know, portraying them in the music videos, or suggestions that somehow we need to step in and protect, you know, how these women are being treated in the music video.
Yeah, and it suggests that they're not in control of these images, and that all of the images are some way described in the context of how they reflect black masculinity.
Right.
And that brings us to the whole question of how black lesbians are seen within the black community, and how they may be threatening to the notion of black masculinity.
Yeah, I mean, this came to a head for me after the book was done. You know, next week is the Millions More March movement, you know, the Nation of Islam's 10-year anniversary of the Million Man March. And one of the figureheads of the speech, Reverend Willie Wilson, gave a rant of a sermon from his pulpit in July in Washington, D.C., in which he essentially said that because black men can't get work, black men can't stay in the household, and that forces black women into lesbian relationships, right? And in fact, he pays part of the blame on black men not being able to have work to black women who are out in the workforce and thus taking jobs away from black men. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting kind of thing because, you know, it was very hateful both in terms of misogyny and homophobia. And as someone who's been hoping that someone like Louis Farrakhan has kind of mellowed and progressed around sexual politics, I found that to be very troubling. And this is a critique I hear all the time around black men that, you know, we can't be men if we don't have jobs. If we can't provide for our family, we can't, you know, be men in our families and thus we leave the household. And one of the things I'm arguing in this book, you know, we need to redefine what kinds of roles men can play in a household. If the woman is, if a wife or a girlfriend or whatever is out working in the world and someone has to take care of domestic space, why can't it be black men who become domestics the same way that black women are domestic? Why can't black men be the one who do laundry and who mop the floor and cook the food, the same things that we expect of black women? And to say that black men can't do those things, right, is to deny and downgrade the humanity of black women by saying that black women are the only ones can do this, because it disparages the kinds of things that they do in the household.
But you also take a look at the double standard by which prejudice and discrimination against black or lesbians, gay women, is treated in the black and white community, and talked about Shamika Gunn.
Yeah, I mean, the case of Shamika Gunn was very troubling. It's a 15-year-old black woman who was an out lesbian who had gone out to party in New York City. She was from New Jersey. And they were coming home 2:00 in the morning, waiting at a bus stop. And a young man came up to her in a car, two of them, and tried to hit on the young women. And their quick response was, "We're not interested." And when they kept persisting, their response was, "We're lesbians." And the young men took that as an attack, right? And then eventually they get into an altercation, and 15-year-old, you know, Shamika Gunn is stabbed to death. And what was so striking about the case was the literal silence within the black press and the black community about her death. Part of that was, you know, what we now know is a natural inclination to close ranks around black masculinity, whether it's Jesse Jackson or Mayor Marion Barry or Mike Tyson or R. Kelly, who I talk about, the musician, a great deal in the book. So close ranks around those things when black men are engaged in very damaging activity. But also Shamika Gunn's sexuality raised questions about whether or not she was simply in the wrong because she's a 15-year-old girl out 2:00 in the morning who's having lesbian relations. It somehow was part of her lack of moral fiber that may be more to blame, and thus lack of moral fiber within the black community, than any real blame on the man who was eventually convicted for killing her.
877-962-9862, a number to call if you want to join the conversation with Mark Anthony Neal, author of New Black Man. Leroy is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Leroy.
How are you today?
Good.
To you and your guest. I believe that there is an innate built-in resistance to homophobia in the black male community, because I think we have to really realize that when the slave owners went to Africa and there was basically no homosexuality in Africa before the white slave owners came and brought us back here, and they were having sex with the men and the women, girls and the boys. And in modern history, I do believe that you have to really go back to the mid to early 60s to really get a grasp on the fact that, and just realize point blank that Everybody comes to this country to escape tyranny and oppression, and they know they're going to get a fair shot here, but black men were the only race of people who were brought here exclusively to be oppressed. And if you can get your mind wrapped around that, you'll understand that the black man is never going to really progress in this country in any way until we realize that we have really, I'll be 60 Sunday, and we have really just neglected our young black men. You can trace this back to the mid-60s during the Vietnam War, which was by design to really just kill off the black men because they were in Vietnam in such a disproportionate number that I think the white establishment really realized that they were going to come back either in body bags, psychologically damaged, or drug addicts. And we didn't really have a real drug problem in the black community until the mid-60s. Then you come up with integration, especially in North Carolina, which reached, even though it was progressing in 54 in Arkansas, it really didn't reach North Carolina until the late 60s, which the white establishment had about 20 years to design about how they were going to defeat it. And one of the ways that they did was to socially promote these young black men. And now we look at the generations of young black men who have been socially promoted for generations. Now we have a dumbing down of the black community. And I know your show is long, and I could just go on and on, but I just really want to bring the fact that bring to the point the fact that there is such a disconnect between the elite educational black community and the so-called blue collar, and even down lower than that to the thug on the street,
Leroy, let me get a response to that because you're making a good point, and I really want to get a response to that notion of the disconnect and how this intellectual discussion we're having here can at all play out on the streets and in the academies and in the business and the boardrooms.
And I think there's some legitimacy to that. I mean, one of the things that I struggle with, and my background is working class and blue collar, right? My father has a 10th grade education. So I come from those kind of spaces, right? And obviously I'm invested in the idea of public schools. So my two daughters, at least my oldest daughter, goes to public school, you know, so there is a connection here. But there is always a danger that we're having intellectual discussions about these things that may not resonate, right, in a kind of way on the ground. And at least for me, you know, whether it's a forum like this or speaking in churches or speaking in community or speaking in prisons, right, is a way to try to close that gap. Now, much of what the caller just said, I agree with. I mean, the Vietnam War observation is particularly compelling. The one thing I would challenge, right, is this kind of notion that somehow homosexuality came into Africa with the slave traders. I mean, there have been a fair amount of folks who are now doing scholarship now that's looking at African history that suggested there were patterns within African family structures that allowed, for instance, for two wives in some cases, right? So to say that somehow homosexuality is a totally foreign concept to Africa may not necessarily be the case.
Well, I want you to clarify that. I mean, two wives doesn't suggest to me homosexuality. On the
yeah, and that's some of the work in terms of the scholarship the folks are trying to work through, right? You know, we understand that there's a situation where women could be married. That doesn't necessarily mean what's playing out on the ground. Ultimately, for me, even if we want to accept an argument that somehow homosexuality is a product of white supremacy, how do we then still affirm the humanity of those folks who are gays and lesbians without necessarily denying their humanity and denying their blackness? And the reality is that there are gay men, black gay men in this country who are very productive and strong fathers. There are gay men in this country who adopt kids and are fathers, who adopt foster kids in this country. To suggest that somehow gay men don't have an investment in the black community and somehow that they're damaged is to deny the fact that we have a wide range of gays and lesbians in our community who have always been productive citizens and who have added to the best of what we are as a black community.
Let's go back to the phones. Alfie is on the line. Hi, Alfie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question, or I guess really I wanted to get Dr. Neal's perspective on middle and upper middle class black men. I can tell you a quick story to give you some context. I have some friends, colleagues, brother, family members who've told me as professional middle class men, they've had experiences where they have to reduce the bass in their voice on a daily basis at work so as not to intimidate the people with whom they work. To me, I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry actually at the medical center at Duke. I just wonder how that might affect someone's psyche to have to do something like that consciously on a regular basis.
Thanks, Elfie.
That's a great question. And I think that speaks to the fact that because we don't have a diversity of black male imagery in society, that even as we're having this conversation within the black community, right, there clearly are folks in the large society who read black masculinity in very unsophisticated and simplistic ways. And very often it is, in fact, because they don't want to be seen as threatening. They want to be, have the impact of influencing people within their work sphere, that some black men may have to play a game where they don't go directly to who they are as black men and come off as softer as a way to negotiate those kind of spaces. Ultimately, that's an issue that the large society simply has not, I think, you know, been exposed to a wider range of black masculinity in order to allow for some of that diversity.
What it also suggests that more than a double consciousness, we're looking at quadruple and quintuple consciousnesses, having to deal with impulses that you may have to nurture that you may not feel acceptable at home and yeah, that sort of thing. 877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join the conversation with Mark Anthony Neal of Duke University, who is the author of New Black Man. Zelda's on the line from Hillsboro. Hello, Zelda.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm the parent of a 19-year-old African-American male, and he's been raised to have freedom to explore his identity as a black male. And I'm also the sister of a my brother grew up in our household being beaten by my father for being a sissy. And he had pretty low self-esteem, and his life ended at age 33. He died of AIDS, but I'm pretty convinced that his lack of self-esteem, that he would have, that his being beaten for being queer would have led to his demise in some manner. Anyway, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about the irony of that kind of control, be it physical control or spiritual or mental control within the black community household, that can lead to the death, literally, if not the death of spirit, of our young men, and how I think it's important to...
Zelda, I need to leave time for response, and I'm running up against the end of the show, so I want to thank you for that and get a response. Thanks,
right,
Zelda.
Thank you.
That's a very great question that you asked, Zelda. A great point that you bring up. One of the studies that I cited in the book suggests that, you know, black gay men, for instance, tend to have a healthier relationship with their sexuality in terms of the kind of practices they do every day in terms of having safe sex, et cetera, when they're in spaces where their homosexuality is embraced and accepted and respected. In cases where black men who are gay are having to struggle and negotiate their sexuality within various communities, their family, their churches, et cetera, they tend to engage in more damaging practices around unsafe sex and a range of other things, right? So the idea that a much more healthy environment for black men obviously would be one that's anti-homophobic. Same thing with black lesbians. The other thing that's very interesting about Zelda's comments, you know, we have a conversation where we always hear that, you know, black gays and lesbians have always been accepted within the black community. And a lot of that is kind of a public performance, right? You know, prior to segregation, we really can't openly attack gays and lesbians if black folks as a whole are under attack. And what we very rarely discuss are the conversations about what is happening in these households when homosexuality becomes a threat. And I think a lot of the black queer writers, both black gays and lesbians, who've written about what's happening in these domestic spaces, that suggests that there's always been an issue of homophobia within the black community.
Mark Anthony Neal, fascinating discussion. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal is an associate professor of black pop culture in the African and African American Studies Department at Duke University and author of New Black Man. That's our program. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Frank Stachow.